From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a National Science Foundation grant is supporting the Milwaukee Public Museum's participation in a coordinated national project. We'll learn more from the museum's research curator. Then, as sports betting becomes more common in the U.S., we look at the possible repercussions and the history of gambling on sports.
In 1919, gamblers fixed the World Series. The Chicago White Sox lost on purpose to the Cincinnati Reds. And I think that really sort of set people against sports gambling as a concept.
And Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour dazzles us with some tasty playing. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. The National Science Foundation announced this summer that the Milwaukee Public Museum would be receiving a $4.3 million grant. The money will be used to digitize more than 1.3 million arthropod specimens. Those are things like ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. The museum, along with 25 other institutions across the country, will create the Terrestrial Parasite Tracker. This digital database will help track the spread of diseases like Lyme and West Nile viruses and should help people working in human health and safety, agriculture, and wildlife conservation. Dr. Jennifer Zaspel, MPM's research curator and head of zoology, will take the lead on this national project, and she joins me in the studio now. Dr. Zaspel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You specialize in something that I think a lot of people would probably go, ew, parasites.
Yes, to some extent, I do study creepy crawly parasites. My research program, in the context of parasitology, is focused on a group of moths that pierces animal tissue and feeds on their blood. So they are vampire moths. And so that's my study system.
Those are subjects of a lot of people's nightmares.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think that's correct.
Like,
yeah.
Flesh-piercing moths is one of those things.
Right.
It's a great band name, and it's also something that you think, wow, nature is amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no limit to what you can find in nature, for sure.
So when we use the term parasite, scientifically, what do we mean by that? I mean, that word is used for a lot of different things. But when you, as a professional researcher, what are you talking about when you talk about a parasite?
Right. So a parasite is an organism that lives on or within another organism and benefits from it, typically by gaining nutrition. This relationship is one-sided, and the host doesn't benefit. In many cases, the relationship is harmful to the host.
So I have to ask, why do we think that exists in nature? Why does that kind of one-sided relationship, usually you'd think it would be a beneficial, you know, I think of the birds that ride around on hippos.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Where, you know, the hippo gets something from it too.
Right. It's more of a symbiotic relationship where both members of that partnership benefit in some way. And, you know, with parasites, I don't know that we're exactly sure how those relationships have evolved. It's something that I've spent a lot of time studying over the past, you know, several years. I've always had a keen interest in gaining a better understanding of how distantly related organisms do form these close associations over time. And in terms of, you know, these parasitic relationships, how, you know, one organism can persist at a cost to the other and how that can maintain itself in the environment over time. I think in a lot of ways, depending on the group that you're talking about, is still a bit mysterious.
Yeah, as a layperson in all of this, I've always thought it interesting, say viruses, for example, that kill the host that they enter. I'm thinking AIDS. You know, eventually the host is going to die, and therefore the virus no longer has a home. And so I think in evolutionary terms, What does that do when that relationship is so toxic that it ends up killing the very thing that you're getting the sustenance from?
Right, absolutely. And I think there is, some literature out there, or certainly it's been hypothesized that parasites can sort of serve as a mechanism for controlling populations, right? And so there is that. But I think evidence to support that claim is still somewhat limited.
So in your job at the Milwaukee Public Museum, what's a day like for you? What are you working on?
Oh, we work on all sorts of things in the collections and research department. So I'm the head of the zoology department, which means I oversee all of the animal collections, vertebrate and invertebrate animal collections at MPM. And so I'm responsible for the care and curation of about 2 to 3 million specimens. We're still inventorying some of our collections to get exact numbers, but that's our estimate. I'm also the director of the Pulicker Butterfly Wing, and so I oversee those operations.
One of the favorite places in the museum, I think, for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what some folks may not know is that in addition to the butterflies that we have in the vivarium, we also have an arthropod rearing lab. And so we have a lot of other live critters in our laboratory spaces, sort of behind the scenes next to the PBW. And then the other hat that I wear is a research curator. And so that means I run a nationally recognized research program. And so I have graduate students, interns, undergraduate students, postdoctoral researchers, and other staff members that work in our various lab spaces with me on a variety of different projects. And so those projects might be the typical things that you would expect from a curator sitting down at the microscope and looking at organisms and, you know, describing new species. But also we do molecular work in my laboratory. And so we look at DNA sequences across different groups of organisms and compare them and build relationships and address questions about their behavior.
So one of the cool things that has just happened is the National Science Foundation has recognized you and the Milwaukee Public Museum with a grant. And what is this grant going to do, and how does it work into the research that you're already doing?
So the NSF grant that we just received will fund a project called Terrestrial Parasite Tracker. And this project is going to be focused on digitizing parasite specimens stored in natural history collections across the United States. And so parasite, as you mentioned, is a broad term that's used to describe many different kinds of organisms. And that could be applied to plants or fungi, worms, other animals, and even protozoans.
I didn't even think of plants as being parasitical.
Are parasitic plants, yes.
Wow.
But the Terrestrial Parasite Project is going to be focused on insect parasites and their relatives, specifically those that occur on land as opposed to water, and also groups that we often refer to as being ectoparasites, so occurring on the organism rather than inside of an organism, which would be an endoparasite.
Ah, okay.
And so examples of the kinds of organisms that fall into this category that we will be working with are fleas, lice, mosquitoes, and other biting flies, ticks, and mites.
All of our friends.
Right.
Yes.
And in terms of geographic scope for the project, we're going to be focusing on the North American species. So that's right around 3,000 species for this project.
And I know that you have a lot of samples at the Milwaukee Public Museum. You're also going to be working with other collections around the state, too, right? Isn't there, like at UW-Stevens Point, they have
right.
some?
Yep.
Madison has
yep.
some?
Yep, University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and University of Wisconsin at Madison are involved in the project, along with support for 20 other natural history collections and research collections in the United States. So we are going to be working with folks from the University of Hawaii to the University of Florida, folks from Texas A&M to the University of Minnesota, Cal Academy all the way to the University of New Hampshire.
How exciting.
Right. And the idea there is, you know, we really want to capture the geographic extent of these parasitic species. And we want to be sure that when it comes to potential invasive parasite species that may come into our borders, that we include the collections in places like Hawaii and Texas and Florida.
So what is the money going to allow you to do that you haven't been able to do so far?
Right. So a lot of these collections, you know, are stored in different spaces, different physical spaces. And so, for example, you might have an institution that has an entomology collection in the entomology department, and there might be a parasitology collection housed in, say, the veterinary school. And so one of the big things that this project is going to allow us to do is pull those collections together in a way that is searchable and in a digital format. This project is also going to allow us to connect the data associated with parasite collections to data that we have that can be connected to their hosts. And so we'll be able to do a search on a particular animal host and pull up all of the information on what types of parasites may be associated with that
and
animal.
And if you see something new, you can say, wait a minute, we haven't seen that.
Right.
This
right.
is different.
Right, right. And and having all of this information in one place will allow us to generate distribution maps. It'll allow us to generate species checklists that might even, you know, have annotations about where a given harmful parasite or species might occur. Right now, we don't have that information all in one place. And so if we want to know where a harmful parasite species occurs or even where it doesn't occur, you know, we can't access that information easily.
Right. There's no Google that's going to pull that up for you.
Not in a way that's actually geographically comprehensive, right? If you find a tick on your dog, you want to know, do I need to be concerned about this species, right? Well, it would be very useful to be able to pull up your phone and take a picture of that organism and have some information about, you know, what it is and whether or not it's harmful. And if so, what should you do about it?
So how long is getting this? It's almost like a digitized library set up. What's the time frame for all of this?
Right. So the project will start September 1st, and it's a three-year effort. There are a lot of different components, you know, besides just, you know, gathering specimen label data to generate distribution maps and checklists. We're also going to be taking a massive number of images of specimens. And so, you know, this advanced imaging technology is going to require a lot of upfront training and coordinating among participants in the network and various staff members. But we will be taking images of specimens on pins. We will be taking images of specimens mounted on slides. We'll be taking images of specimens stored in vials with fluids. And so in terms of the workload that needs to be spread out over those 3 years, you know, we'll have our hands full. We're also hoping to develop some smartphone apps that will help accelerate species identification. We are also going to be working a lot on, you know, sort of building consensus around standards for how to handle this type of data. We really want this data to be research ready at the end of the three-year period. And so we'll be having a lot of workshops and discussions with folks involved in the network and also other collaborators outside of the network to be sure that we're making good decisions about how we're organizing the data that we're generating as a part of this project so that it's easily accessible when it's over.
So at the end of the 3 years is the idea that it will there will be some continuation of like maintenance and addition of data to the I'm calling it a library, but to the what is the proper term? What would it be? It's kind of like this national database, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. And so we have a data portal that we are using as a primary aggregator, you know, where this data will live, as you say. And, you know, we're working all the time to come up with long-term solutions in the context of sustainability of the data that we're generating. It's a massive undertaking, you know, figuring out where the data will go, how it will be delivered, where will we store the images, how will we organize them so that we can find them later for downstream research and for development of these identification tools and brochures and field guides that we hope will be very useful to non-specialists, land managers, folks working on invasive species risk assessment, things like that.
So besides yourself, how many people at NPM are going to be involved working on this project?
So we have right now six folks that will be involved in this project. There will be some additional new hires as we move forward. And I think that the people that we have that are going to be working on this project are seasoned veterans in the land of natural history collections digitization. And, you know, the fact that the Milwaukee Public Museum has prioritized digitization for, you know, the past several years just means that we already have an experienced team sort of built into this. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that we got this award to begin with, is because the museum just does such a great job. And we can serve as a really great model for how to make a big project like this successful.
I assume that once the digitization has happened, that the actual physical specimens aren't going anywhere. They're still going to be available.
That's correct. Right. And to that point, this project hopefully will uncover specimens that, you know, are hidden in places where, you know, we didn't know they existed. We also hope to pull in some collections from, you know, researchers who have their sort of their own laboratory parasite collections. We're hoping to get those digitized and made available as a part of this project and help those folks organize those specimens and get them sort of a more permanent home once they're, you know, wrapping up various research projects that require examination of that material.
Right. And I was going to say that you standardize everything so that people can find it in the future as well.
Right. Yeah. And I think collections standardization is, you know, obviously something that our community, the collections community, does very well. You know, we've been doing it for over 100 years, which makes this such a tremendous resource, right? That material and data is available. But we also need to think about standards for how we're going to push this information into that digital format and make it consistent and useful for all of the things that we'd like to do with it later. And so that requires a lot of thinking ahead. How do we want to use this for research? And then we have to let that sort of guide us as we work to take the physical collections and make them digital.
You have a lot of really interesting work ahead of you for these next 3 years. I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us, and best of luck with all the work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jennifer Zaspel is the Milwaukee Public Museum's research curator and head of zoology. The Terrestrial Parasite Tracker Project got underway September 1st and will go for the next 3 years. Coming up next, the federal ban on sports betting was removed last year and gambling has grown rapidly. But how could it impact professional and amateur sports? We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Until last year, there was a federal ban on commercial sports gambling, but that changed with a Supreme Court ruling last year which legalized it. Because of state constitutions, sports betting is still not legal in many states, including Wisconsin, but the potential repercussions would impact sports fans throughout the country. Mike Meurer is a journalism professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former sports reporter. He's researched media ethics for sports reporters, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about legalized sports gambling and how it's spreading throughout the United States.
So it's happened sort of all over the country in some ways. I think there's 13 states that formally have it legalized now, New Jersey being, I think, the one that led this charge to the Supreme Court. The for our purposes, I think the most interesting ones, you know, Michigan is legalizing it, Illinois is legalizing it, and Iowa is legalizing it. We here in Wisconsin are not. We have constitutional amendments to that ban sports gambling, which creates a whole different type of process here for gambling, for making that legal. So it would require the tribes who run our legal gambling to bring it in, and they're, I think, not eager to do that necessarily. Or it would require, you know, two straight votes from two legislative sessions and then a referendum here.
Okay. So what exactly did the Supreme Court decision do?
So the Supreme Court decision struck down the federal ban on sports gambling, which means that now states, it's sort of up to the states to figure out what they want to do with it. And a lot of states are very eager to, are looking for revenue, and gambling has been one of those things that states have really relied on to find money, to fill holes in the budget. I'm from Detroit originally, and the whole downtown is now run by the casinos because they've given it over to that.
Well, casinos, obviously, but also the lottery has been a consistent, you know, provider of funds in states around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there must have been a reason that sports betting was made illegal to begin with. What's kind of the history there? Why was sports betting in particular illegal versus, you know, the kinds of casinos that we've had for quite a while?
Well, I mean, those casinos were illegal too for a long time. There's been a long effort to legalize them. You know, when sports began, and this is not my deep expertise, but when sports began, they were a haven for gamblers, right? That, you know, when the National League started back in 1876, the same National League that the Brewers play in here, part of what they did was they sort of were building games. The gamblers behind home plate were sort of a well-known trope in the sports writing of the time and in the journalism that people talked about. You know, the phrase, the 3-2 pitch, the payoff pitch, right? Something's going to happen. I mean, that in some sense is a gambling term. So this was always this subculture, and something that people pointed to every time the business of baseball sort of cratered was that, oh, families weren't coming. People were turned off by the gambling and the negative aspects of it. In 1919, gamblers fixed the World Series. The Chicago White Sox lost on purpose to the Cincinnati Reds. And I think that really sort of set people against sports gambling as a concept. And so for the most part, it tended to vanish.
It's funny, when I think of sports betting, I think of the Black Sox scandal, this incident in which, yeah, the World Series was fixed. And, you know, a lot of what we're talking about now is really the repercussions of this move. So as we look at something like baseball, but really all professional sports, what are people afraid of with the rise of sports betting?
I think when you talk about gambling, you are speaking to the integrity of the sport. And I think that's something that really is hard for people to put their fingers on, right? We've seen gamblers, you know, fix baseball games, you know, the World Series in 1919. The sport of college basketball nearly died in its crib in the 1950s because gamblers were so deeply entwined with it. There's these old stories of all these players who would do their summer jobs at the Catskills. They'd meet gamblers, and then the gamblers would, reach out to them during the season. They were fixing games at Madison Square Garden. Nearly ended college basketball before in the 1950s. We even had point shaving scandals, you know, that pop up every now and again in college sports. I think it really goes to the integrity of the game. You know, it's one of those things where Pete Rose, the Cincinnati Reds, great star, is banned from the game for gambling, whereas you have players who are engaging in all sorts of other sort of antisocial behaviors, drugs, domestic violence, all sorts of things, and they're still sort of in good standing because what their crimes do, they don't go to sort of what the game is, what the game means, whether the game is on the level. And so I think that's why gambling is really this thing that puts a lot of people on edge when they think about it.
You mentioned, of course, college sports, and there's a broad conversation right now about college sports in general, NCAA rules that really inhibit a player's ability to make money or in some cases survive. You know, they're not allowed to really get jobs outside of playing these sports in college. So they're really struggling. And we have some states that are looking to now make rules that would allow players to be paid. But for the most part, we're not looking at that. And this would be a way for players to, yes, get paid. Is that of concern?
I think it has to be of incredible concern. And I think there's some sense that we don't know necessarily what's happening because a lot of this happens under the surface. But the thing about gambling is that it monetizes information, right? So details about what's happening in the games or what's going to happen gets an economic value. And so if you're the third string linebacker on the University of New Mexico's football team, you know whether your player is going, you know, whether your better player is going to play, and you don't have a pro career to look forward to. That's always been a concern, I think, for college sports, and one of the reasons I think that's been put forward for not legalizing sports gambling. I think legalizing it may bring it out into the open, may make it harder to monetize that information, because it'll be more of an open process and people monitor unusual betting flows. So that's one thing that might change the calculus at all. But, you know, I do wonder at some of these small, you know, I went to a small Division I college for undergrad, and I do wonder. There are people who just bet these small leagues. I mean, that's something that exists. So I'm sort of wondering what the basis of those bets are, where they're getting information. There's not a lot of media that was covering Ivy League basketball when I was going to school there in the early 2000s. So I don't know. So I've always wondered, and I don't have any proof one way or the other how much information is getting out of these team huddles about sort of who's going to play and who's not going to play. And I think that's something that college sports, the model of not paying people, when you go back to the stories of the 1950s, that was part of why people were throwing games, is they wanted money. And so the desire for money hasn't changed generally.
The desire and often the necessity for.
Yes.
And of course, you know, you bring up a point inside of that, that people can bet on anything. At the same time, there's a lot of money in the NCAA, in professional sports, baseball, basketball, hockey, whatever you're talking about. But there are ways that this transparency can allow for kind of oversight. So what does that look like moving forward? Do we really know?
I'm not sure we really know. I think one of the things that we're seeing is that in Europe, where a lot of these scandals happen more out in the open, they're not happening at the top levels of, say, European soccer, right? So there's enough money in the highest level sports that you're not going to have a Black Sox situation again, right? Because the minimum salary and the salaries are enough that it's not worth the money to throw a game here or there, right? And I think that's something that the escalation of salaries has done. When you look in Europe, you see sort of lower level tennis, you see lower level soccer. You know, in these European countries, the soccer pyramids go down, you know, many, many levels. And you can bet on those games too. And those players are Sunday league players. They've got part-time jobs. They're not full-time professionals. And there is, I think, a recipe for fixing games in that. I think that's where you see more of the scandals right now. When they pop up. Having it be open, I think, does, again, deal with some of that. But in some of these smaller sports where there's not a lot of money coming in one way or the other, it may be more difficult to see unusual patterns in the way that bets are coming in.
So this might not be something that we're concerned about necessarily with the Green Bay Packers, but some of these smaller teams and leagues, that's perhaps where things might go awry.
Yeah, I mean, I think UWM has to be very careful about the way that it approaches these questions, right? Because there's not a lot of media transparency around the team. You know, they don't have beat writers assigned to them the way the Badgers do, the way that, you know, larger athletic departments do. So I think that is a concern. There is a lack of transparency in what news comes out around Horizon League basketball, right, or Big Sky basketball, right? These places where there's not a lot of day-to-day media coverage. I think media is very important in this process because it does create a measure of transparency. I think so as gambling becomes more of a public, more legal and more open, I think making sure that teams are being transparent about injuries, not creating sort of inside information, that's something that smaller sporting organizations have to really be focused on.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mike Meyer is a journalism professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former sports reporter. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take one last break, and then Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour performs for us in Studio C. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Antoine Dufour signed with Milwaukee's Candy Rat Records in 2005, before the label was actually even open for business. He remains one of the label's most popular artists, and he's released 6 albums, 2 DVDs, and has more than 50 million views on YouTube. Dufour, who's based in Montreal when he's not touring, has been in town this week performing and teaching at UWM's fingerstyle guitar program, and he'll play a concert Thursday night at the St. Kate Arts Hotel. He stopped by our studio first to share some music, and here he is with his own composition, These Moments. These Moments, Antoine Dufour in Lake Effect's performance studio. Merci beaucoup.
Oh, merci.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, you are one of my favorite guitarists. So when the opportunity came to have you in the studio, I could not say no.
Wow, so, such an honor.
Yeah, it's well, you know, you play so beautifully, and I just love the textures that you get from the guitar. You manage to find all these different sounds and different shapes of sound within it. When did you first start playing? Were you one of those child prodigies?
No, actually, not at all. I was 15 years old. Yeah. My dad was playing a little bit of guitar, so he showed me a few chords. I've learned my first songs, very simple things. And 2 years after, I started being interested in some classical stuff. Well, through a progressive rock band called Yes, there's this Steve Howe guitar player there, and he was playing this song called Mood for a Day. It's kind of a classical feel to it. And then at the time, I didn't know how to play that stuff, so I would pick my guitar and, you know, I learned it all the way through. I was able to play it with the recording, sync with the recording. But at the time, I was just playing with my thumb and index of my right hand. And anyways, I got to be able to do it. And then I applied in college for actually a double program, which was a music and also pure sciences. It's like a 3-year program we have in Quebec. The system is a little different over there, but we have. So I've been studying the two things kind of together over 3 years, but that's where I really discovered that I wanted to do music. So no more sciences for me, but I enjoy it. But yeah, it was a lot of work. But anyways, I really discovered a lot of music, guitar music over there, because my teacher was really open. It was a classical guitar teacher, but he was really listening to many things, like all fingerstyle stuff, like Leo Kottke, Pierre Bensusan, Michael Hedges, and Don Ross. And then when one day he lent me a cassette of Don Ross. It's like, it was actually a, like a copied cassette, like
a bootleg.
Yeah, and then I listened to it. I was like, wow, how is this guy can do that on a guitar? It was like, and back in the day, there were no YouTube videos or anything. It was like in 97 or 98. So I wanted to learn that stuff. So I started to find materials like VHS cassette of, classes that Don Ross would do. And I could see this, how he was achieving those sounds. Started learning his songs. And that's mostly how I got into that, is really through learning a lot of Don Ross tunes. So he's kind of my mentor, I guess.
He's played in here too.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That's such a great guy. And then over the years, I've been lucky enough to also open for him or play shows with him and on the road. So he's been always a big influence.
He's an influence, but what I really like about your music is that you're not a direct copy of him. You've taken what he does and you've absorbed it into yourself and into your own music and created your own sound,
Thank you. I try. I mean, I've been always taking a little bit here and there. So there's, of course, Don Ross is like the one that really, put me on a certain track. But after that, I also discovered many other players. Like, I really love Stephen Bennett, which is a wonderful writer. He writes, like, unbelievable melodies. Michael Hedges, Leo Kottke, all that stuff, really. I learned a little bit here, a little bit there. And just to have tools, just to build up my bag of tools.
You mentioned something I think really important, and that's melody. And sometimes when I hear fingerstyle guitar players, it's a lot of technique, but there isn't a lot of melody. There's not something that my ear can hang on to. And I think that's something that you do so well. I think maybe that's one of the reasons I like your playing so much, is that there is a through line, a melody that I can follow.
Well, thank you. Because it's that's something very important, I think, and especially in instrumental guitar music, because it's already instrumental, so people are not used to listen to that so much. They listen to the voice all the time, so they're not like trained to listen to instrumental music, and especially guitar. So it could be just a background music, but if you give them like elements that they can grab, like a good melody, a rhythm, built like a song that they would hear differently, like what I like to do is to work, if I was a band, like I have a bass player, a drummer, a keyboard player, and a singer. So that's kind of what I'm trying to emulate. So and use structures that people could follow and grab onto something they know already, kind of in other type of music.
So. Right. Something they'd hear on the radio, that song format. Do you start with a melody when you write, or does it depend?
It depends, yeah, but most of the time, actually not. I have to kind of build on something. So I sometimes like to go with a simple idea, just a riff, a few chords, a rhythm, and I'll probably loop that and maybe record it if I can, and then I will sing on top of that, or I will... sometimes I use a Guitar Pro, which is a software that you can write your music in there, and then it plays it for you. So it's sometimes cool to hear what it does. Sometimes I will use that, and then I will try to sing something, and I will make an arrangement. So I have to find like a good tuning that will work for it, or so I have to try to write all those parts together and learn it and make sure if I can solve problems. Just trying to find like there's this fingering here, this, that, this, and that. I have to make all those things together. How can I do that? So I need to find solutions. So it's a really problem-solving type of thing.
That's where your science background comes in, of that whole experimenting and trying again and finding it.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good thing. Yeah, maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised. There's some method to it that where you're trying, as you say, to solve a problem, and you have to get through the various pieces of it in order to make it all work.
Yeah, and also when I started writing, was not like that. I was like more trying stuff, and it was really intuitive, I guess. And okay, let's try. But the more I wrote, the more I was like finding different ways, different approach. And I find like the best for me is if I have nothing, and I don't know if I'm in front of a blank page, I will listen to some music that I like. I'll try to analyze it and find a cool idea, and then build on it, write, sing, and it's gonna work. It's gonna make it eventually, so that's kind of a method I develop for myself. It doesn't mean that it's going to work for everybody, but for me, I mean, it works.
Well, how did you come to the song we're going to hear next, which is 30 Minutes in London? I'm assuming that that was based in some experience that you had.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, the title is kind of evocative, I guess. But I was in England with the International Guitar Night back in, I think it's in 06. We were mostly doing Scotland and a few dates in England. And when you had this this last show was in Dartford next to London. And there was this this place called the Mick Jagger Center where we were playing. It's full of, you know, there's a lot of images of Mick Jagger, which is, it's okay if you like Mick Jagger. No, so anyways, but yeah, that was a fun gig there. And then we, that was the last one. And I was starting writing this riff, maybe, I think the previous day in the hotel room. And then after that, we took a train from Dartford to London. And in London, we stopped for lunch and we had a little bit of time. So we're looking at the time, and we had a good half hour, so why not? So we just decided to visit London in a half hour. So basically it was just to go and jump in the subway, and we went to the Buckingham Palace, and it was like, wow, let's stay there for a minute or two, watch it, check it out, you know, from outside. And then, you know, we had to run again to the next subway, and, we had to go to the airport finally. So basically that's kind of the story of that. And then I finished the song at home and kind of in that way, you know, created this very, you know, quick, busy riff that people are like, you know.
Rushing in
London.
Yeah,
rushing. And then, this all moment and you can like stop and check stuff and go back into the subway and, you know, do the rush again. So it's like a little bit of a stop in time. So I guess that's it. That's
okay.
30 Minutes in London.
Well, this is 30 Minutes in London with Antoine Dufour in Lake Effect's Performance Studio. Thank you. Yes, 30 minutes in London, indeed, or any big city for that matter. It's like, it's exactly it. Antoine Dufour in Lake Effect's Performance Studio, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
You are at the point in your career where younger players are looking to you for guidance and looking to you for, you know, whether you're teaching them, whether they just want to sit and watch you and pick up things the way you did when you were first learning. How does that feel to kind of have made that transition?
I don't know. That's weird. I would never have imagined that, you know, my life was not necessarily the goal either, but it's just like, wow, it's pretty humbling. It's good. It's nice.
What do you tell young guitarists who come to you? I mean, what are some of the things that you look for in their playing and then talk to them about?
I mean, their own sound, if they have this little thing that they do and they're really good at, like their like collar, if you will, just to keep that, go into that direction, to work hard on that, to have their own signature sound. Also being very musical, like you were talking about the melody, you know, singing more, maybe writing a little more, because a lot of them are just like noodling and finding stuff. It's cool. Sometimes it creates really good ideas. I have nothing against that. I've done that myself, and I do that still sometimes. But, I mean, it has to come to another layer, another level. So sometimes you have to really sit down and write more, sing more, or use other instruments and just to create and then transfer it to the guitar and just to have like an extra dimension. So those people sometimes have this extra work to do. And doing that, you progress as well. Like I feel I've been getting better at playing just because I was writing this way. That forced me to you know, had those ideas to put together. I could not play it. I had to figure out a way to make it happen. So I have to really, like we were talking about problem solving. So I think that's something they have to do more. And it, when you start to do that work, it starts to show and become a lot more interesting.
After your concert at St. Kate's on Thursday, what's next? What are you doing? Are you touring? Are you recording a new album? What's
happening? Actually, I'm touring. I'm doing... this show on Thursday night at the St. Kate Hotel, and it's going to be cool. So at 8 p.m. And then after that, I have to fly to Detroit. There's these guys, Fingerstyle Michigan Association over there. That's pretty cool. They've been having me a few times in the past. I'm doing two concerts there near Detroit area, and teaching also like clinics there. Great bunch of guys that organizes a lot of those concerts, acoustic guitar concerts over throughout the years. So I'm doing that, and then after that I'm going to Indianapolis to play two shows there, and I meet my buddy Adrian Belew, which is another fellow young guitar player. He's a great guy, and we're gonna do a few gigs together, those two in Indianapolis, and then we go to near Chicago, and then one in Minneapolis. So
and then home,
and that's it. Yeah, home. And catch up on other things.
Yes, the rest of your life.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am so pleased you were able to spend a little bit of time here on this tour. It's such an honor to have you in the studio, Antoine. And thank you so much for playing for us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. Thank you very much.
What are you going to take us out with?
It's called Mother. Thank you.
Canadian guitarist Antoine Dufour performing his composition Mother in Lake Effect's performance studio. Our in-studio concert was engineered by Jason Reavy. Dufour will give a free concert Thursday evening at the St. Kate Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. There's more information as well as all of the tunes that he performed for us at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.